a deuxième Côte d'Ivoire a fait savoir de participer aux qualifications de l'assemblement qui compose de 250 corps de métier et 8 grandes activités selon l'UEMOA, Union économique et monétaire Ouest africain. La CDC a commencé en faisant là aussi en termes de 157 secteurs en compte. Ces secteurs sont de nature à abîmer toute proposition fiable et de promotion au plan national et international. Il faut noter que l'artisanat contribue à l'auteur des 10% dans la croissance du jeu et la Côte d'Ivoire est en force de 40% des Ivoiriens. La promotion de l'artisanat a la capacité de résister au choc économique et s'appuie aux besoins sociaux des Ivoiriens. La journée de l'artisanat des Ivoiriens se tiendra le 5 septembre prochain. Général et M. Dominique Baston dans la 4e édition de l'Union Forum Africa ont déclaré que le continent noir devait multiplier des efforts pour assurer les investisseurs. M. Baston a appuyé sur la proposition de ses collègues en disant que l'Afrique devait envisager d'améliorer sa gouvernance et renforcer son infrastructure. Il a mis l'accent sur la mise en application des décisions importantes des pays africains. Le sujet sur l'immigration n'a pas été oublié. Monsieur Baston propose à l'Europe de considérer les immigrants comme un moyen de pallier à la carence de la main d'œuvre sur ce continent. D'autres personnalités économiques et politiques ont reçu de leur présence à cette rencontre. C'est le cas du président du Niger, Alassane Ouattara, de la ministre française de l'Environnement et du Développement durable et de l'énergie, Ségolène Fayad. C'était dimanche que la 4e édition du New York Forum a clos. Il avait comme thème investir dans l'énergie du continent. Et c'est sur cette note que nous cédons l'antenne à Boïs Sabila qui nous présente le bulletin des informations économiques du jour. Au Cameroun, journaliste travaillant dans le Sénat ont été mis en garde. Simon Akeba, journaliste d'investigation, et Ahmed Abdel, du service Aoussa de RFI au Cameroun, sont soupçonnés de lien avec le Kouara. Une accusation que le président du syndicat national des journalistes du Cameroun rejette en bloc. Mini Kouébo a par ailleurs exigé la libération immédiate et sans condition de deux chevaliers de la police. Suivons-le au micro de Guillaume Kabissoso.
Palacieux de Saint-Denis qui est mis en avant Économique du continent africain nous aussi initiative du fonds Afrique 50.
Ce qui a montré la création de ce fonds,
c'est le sentiment que l'auteur prend un thème de financement des infrastructures
n'a pas été rempli par les moyens publics actuellement disponibles.
Donc il fallait trouver un instrument pour utiliser l'épargne à long terme, l'épargne africaine et notamment l'épargne extra-africaine. Et pour des projets qui sont viables sur le plan de corruption. Donc essentiellement, un nouvel instrument pour financer les infrastructures avec les capitaux privés. Alors, le fonds Afrique a deux guichets. Il y a un guichet pour réguler les projets, pour les amener à un niveau et qu'ils soient valables. C'est un défi actuel pour les pays africains. Et puis le deuxième volet, et financement donc pour des projets qui seront viables sur le plan financier.
En 10 ans, les finances du groupe de la BAD ont augmenté avec un capital qui se chiffre aujourd'hui à 3 milliards de dollars, dont 40% sont détenus par 6 pays membres, même africains, dont les États-Unis, la France et le Japon. Certains économistes estiment que le principal succès dont est crédité le Maharaja est d'avoir réussi à éviter aux économies africaines d'être balayées par la grande crise financière de l'économie. La BAD, fondée en 1964, est aujourd'hui l'une des plus grandes institutions de prêt en Afrique. Le successeur de Donald Kaberuka, Adesina, est ministre du Jardin de l'Agriculture et du Développement Rural, sera investi dans ce projet le 1er septembre 2015. Et voilà qui nous mène tout droit au bulletin des sports présenté par Jacques.
Bonjour, commençons par le Mali. Le président a cédé et destitué
un comité de normalisation en place.
Les rendissements de la famille du président Mali, donc sur la demande de la majorité des votants, c'est-à-dire 31 personnes sur 35, et l'Assemblée générale extraordinaire a destitué le voisin Bonadjara de son poste de président de la FEMACOUP, en tant que la Fédération mondiale de football. Élu en 2013, le bureau de Boubacar Babaziara était contesté depuis quelques semaines. Une dizaine de membres sont rentrés pour la malattente. Cette assemblée qui est de l'article français et le statut de règlement de la FEMACOUP. La même texte exige l'application et résolution de cette assise. L'ancien ministre de forme, Marie-Sous Papalé, a été désigné pour diriger un comité de normalisation. En 2017, Emmanuel Adebayor a contre Djibouti la question reste posée. Convoqué pour le match face à Djibouti le 4 septembre prochain, Emmanuel Adebayor suivi la France pour l'heure contre l'arrivée. Comme Saint-Pierre ne sait pas si la section de septembre va rejoindre les éperviers pour la rencontre. C'était du Sébé, j'avais donné à un autre qui m'attend en conférence de presse vendredi. Adebayor est le seul joueur à n'avoir pas répondu à la présentation. Nous lui donnons jusqu'à samedi midi pour qu'il se prononce, a indiqué le technicien de Sébé, mais avant après, c'est réveillé par ce que vous pensez. Au cœur du but, la victoire contre le Libéria par le score de 1 lors de la première fusionnée. Tout le monde a Adebayor le temps de faire succès sur son mercato. Le capitaine des éperviers du Togo, entre-temps annoncé avec insistance du côté d'un candidat, pourrait s'engager en faveur des West Ham en cette du mercato. Une période qui préoccupe tous les joueurs qui se cherchent et qui sont en quête de nouveaux clubs et où sont en véritablement avec leur propre. Parlons à présent de transfert. Même Didier Deschamps est impressionné par le transfert de Martial. Anthony Martial pour la vie merci à Didier Deschamps, le sélectionneur des Bleus qui avait fait appel à l'attaquant monégasque de 19 ans. Pour la première fois, a donné une ouverte à ce dernier pour aller s'engager avec Manchester United ce lundi. Anthony va demander cette autorisation pour lui permettre de répondre à ses obligations médicales de signer son contrat dont il nous rejoindra. Donc, il nous rejoindra donc demain matin, c'est-à-dire mardi. A expliqué Dédé à la tête des publicitaires français, nommé l'équipement, 72 matchs de l'année contre le Portugal, en Bretagne et la Serbie 3 jours plus tard à Bordeaux. Le montant du transfert énorme en voie générer les sorties individuelles auxquelles pourrait s'ajouter environ 10 millions en plus éventuellement. On parle des champs,
que la réalité d'aujourd'hui est bon.
Il y a un seul acheteur qui met une somme très importante.
À partir du moment où l'âge comme un coup accepte,
c'est que le joueur, avec un fort potentiel,
il devait juste rétraper un équipe.
Enfin, que tout est allé très vite depuis son départ du milieu en 2013 et contre 5 millions, notamment, c'est passé à la seconde qui nous sort. Après, il y a moins de risques d'investir sur un jeune que sur un joueur plus âgé. Est-ce que c'est le bon choix pour Anthony? Pas dans certains jeunes pour continuer à investir. Évidemment, il change un peu le public, c'est à la fille, à lui, de continuer sa progression d'avoir tout le jeu.
Pour les futurs africains
au championnat européen.
Allemagne, par exemple, a fait deux sorties de
football. Lundi, pour Castillo a débloqué son compteur, puis avec son nouveau club, l'Allemagne s'accroche.
Le néerlandais de régime Nakaverdien a assuré d'un plat du pied avant d'en remettre un autre avec un habile enchaînement tranché extérieur qui est croisé.
Le germain de l'Italien avait dégagé 1-1 à 20h30 pour Stuttgart avant le retard à domicile.
Thank you.
c'est pas cool.
The opportunity to respond, but it will not disclose the sources that gave evidence in general. Zimbabwe's Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa could be frontly positioning himself as his sole successor to President Robert Mugabe, following an interview he held with the London-based New African magazine. And you'll see Mnangagwa, who spoke broadly about his past, the liberation struggle and the long years he has spent with Mugabe, seems to suggest that none of the current leaders of the ruling ZANU-PF party could feel the veteran leader's shoes.
Published in the state-owned Herald newspaper, Mnangagwa said he had benefited from Mugabe's character of vision ever since he started working with him in the 1960s. Mnangagwa, however, quickly said being vice president was not a stepping stone to becoming president. Following the interview, the Minister of Higher and Tertiary Education, Jonathan Moyo, took to social media to challenge Mnangagwa's remarks, saying it was premature for the vice president to say Zimbabweans would miss Mugabe.
And finally, five people have been arrested in South Africa's OR Tambo International Airport after being found with undeclared currency totaling nearly $6 million. The South African Revenue Service spokesperson Luda Libelo says the passengers were scheduled to leave South Africa to Dubai. He says the five were in possession of 8 luggage bags and 4 backpacks. Libelo says those they too. When they saw South officials, they fled to the boarding gate entrance where they were cornered and taken to
customs. Officials identified these passengers. Customs officials at our OR Tambo Airport apprehended 5 individuals who were in possession of the currency to the value of an estimated 78 million. And these passengers were scheduled to depart by the future on United Arab Emirates flight.
Channel Africa News, I'm Uni Lisa. Africa Digest. You're listening to Africa Digest.
Well, thank you very much, Onele. Your time is 19:06 Central African Time. And the Egyptian court on Saturday sentenced 3 journalists to 3 years in prison each for aiding a terrorist organization spreading false news and working without a license. Mohamed Fahmy, Bahir Mohamed, and Peter Grest were originally sentenced to 7 to 10 years in prison on charges that included spreading lies to help a terrorist organization. A U.S. and to the Muslim Brotherhood, which the military toppled from power 2 years ago. A retrial was ordered after the court said that the journalists were convicted despite a lack of evidence. Executive Director at the Afro-Middle East Center, Naim Jenna, elaborated.
The ruling this weekend was quite shocking. It claimed that everyone expected that the court would overturn the previous decision and they would be free. And that hasn't happened. Of course, and they now have to serve 3 years. At least the 2 of them that I knew just have to serve 3 years.
The original ruling and the original court
was a fact. There was no
evidence provided for the claims that were made. All kinds of illegalism, which was presented as evidence, some of which had nothing to do with the court, etc.
And so it was generally expected that any court that would apply its mind would come to a different ruling. The problem, of course, is that courts in Egypt are not independent, and courts in Egypt are extremely politicized. And so this ruling should be seen in the context of that politicization of Egyptian courts, and it being a way in which to, in a sense, teach journalists of office.
In January, an appeals court ordered a retrial, saying that, of course, the initial verdict lacked evidence against the 3 journalists. Seeing that the retrial is taking place and, of course, that an undesirable outcome is taking place, what does this then mean for the media fraternity in Egypt?
Well, the point of this trial and the written judgment is to send a clear message to journalists, particularly foreign journalists, that any kind of dissent or any kind of coverage of dissenters is not going to be tolerated. I mean, the claims that these 3 were involved in the Muslim Brotherhood of Centers is really not that being involved in the Muslim Brotherhood should be a criminal offense, but I'm just saying that you know, those claims are not. And everyone knows that it's not true. So the message is quite clear to foreign journalists in particular that you will not be safe, you will not be protected by members of the
you're a journalist and you're a foreigner, if you are going to give any coverage to foreigners.
And that's to be simple. And the recent terrorism law that he signed in makes it clear that essentially all news that comes out of Egypt must be in line with the official story.
Australian Foreign Minister Julie Bishop made a promise to use his government's diplomatic muscle to have Peter Grace's conviction overturned. Do you see this happening at all?
Well, I doubt very much that, and this is of course speculation, but I doubt very much that through the legal process and through the courts that we're going to have any success in order. I think that once they feel that the message has sufficiently been conveyed to all journalists, that the military president will then decide to pardon them. And if he pardons them, he will, you know, he will then be presented as being this magnanimous character who has pardoned even terrorists, etc. The point is that if they get a presidential pardon, technically they're still guilty of the crime of which they have been accused. All they're getting is a presidential pardon. For them, of course, it means a huge thing because it means that they'll be free. But the message, as I said, will stand against general. So I think that that's what's going to happen. Ultimately, whether that is this year or next year, and try and spin that in a way that makes it seem gracious and magnanimous.
There was Naim Jena. He is the executive director of the Afro Middle Eastern Center, and he was talking to the coordinator earlier on. So, South Africa's parliament is abundant with activities this week. Tomorrow, the National Assembly will debate 38 motion calling for the establishment of an ad hoc committee to inquire into the further President Jacob Zuma should be removed from office. Stellenbosch University will also brief their overnight committee on higher education and training on allegations of racism at the institution. Nuna Mamakia reports.
The DA alleges that President Zuma violated his oath of office by ignoring a court order preventing Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir from leaving the country when he attended the AU summit. The motion will call for the establishment of an ad hoc committee to investigate whether President Zuma should be removed from office. The DA says it does not require a two-thirds majority, but 50% plus one for the committee to be created. Chief Whip John C. and Hayson says there is a prima facie case for the president to answer.
We are calling for the creation of an ad hoc committee to investigate these allegations against President Zuma, to pull the documentation together, to call witnesses, to call President Zuma and those members of the executive who chose willfully and admitted openly that they chose to ignore that court order and those laws, and ask them to plead the case to Parliament for their actions.
The ANC has described the DA's motion as frivolous. Caucus spokesperson Bulotho Motapo says the ANC is ready to debate and defeat the motion.
The court orders, as well as the judgment that have already been given, including the ensuing case that is before the court, has got nothing to do with the president. The president is not on trial. His conduct is not on trial. So this motion, therefore, makes it that fact makes this motion a frivolous motion, and we are ready with consent and superior arguments to confirm it to the dustbin of history, as we have done with the rest of the motions.
Stellenbosch University will also appear before the Portfolio Committee on Higher Education and Training to explain allegations of racism at the university. Chairperson of the committee, Yvonne Forsan, explains.
There's no way we need to get into this allegation and nothing happened. So we also want to look at their turnaround strategy. And then the briefing will also be followed by whether they do have a transformation plan, listen to that, and look at the progress made with regard to implementation of this transformation plan.
Deputy President Cyril Ramaphosa will be answering questions in the FOP on Wednesday. There will also be a debate in the National Assembly on the socio-economic impact of alcohol, drugs and substance abuse in communities and the solutions to the problem. Parliament is also hosting a two-day women's roundtable discussion on the national development plan and the transformation of the economy to encourage the full participation of women.
If you had feedback on this and other stories, remember that you can find us on social media. We are on Channel Africa One. That is Channel Africa One.
on this Twitter, and you can also get us out from there. We are on info@channelafrica.co.za. That's info@channelafrica.co.za. Now, the detention of people often results forth as they repent of the meek, which violates fundamental human rights and is often used to spread terror within society. This is a method connected to the United Nations International Day after the victims of enforced disappearances observed annually on 30 August. According to the UN, a forced disappearance qualifies as a crime against humanity and gives a victim's family the right to seek reparations. More from a member of the UN Committee on Enforced Disappearances, Ray Nakio.
It's beginning from back to the 70s and 80s. When the phenomenon of forced disappearance as a repressive technique by a certain state, especially at that time in Latin America, was perceived as a specifically pernicious procedure that had terrible effects on not only the direct victims, but the presence of their families. So that there was a feeling that this crime needed a special name and a special treatment. So the United Nations, rather early in the, I think it was in 82, passed the resolution, and in the new millennium, several states, including Argentina, France, worked for the convention to be ratified in 2006.
Have you seen any positive changes since the convention was put into force?
This is very difficult to answer because as a committee, we have an official look only on those countries that have ratified the convention, which at the moment are 50. Different from the working group of the United Nations, there's no overall statistics. But I think improvement should not be measured only in terms of statistics. What I envision is really a raise in awareness of the crime.
As you've mentioned, not all member states have signed the convention. What do you think of the reservation and the
doing? I think there are many different reasons. I think you probably have, in some states, since it is a young convention, still deliberation about the necessity of ratifying that convention, of certain complications that might bring to the national legal system. So in some cases, I presume there are technical reasons rather than political reasons. If you look at the map, for example, of ratifications of the convention, you'll find quite a few democratic states that have not yet ratified, some of them have even signed the convention. Then, of course, there might be states where there's reluctance because they are not human rights friendly in general, and they do not see why they should get some more problems with international revision, international scrutiny of the behavior through a new convention. And in some other states, there will be a lack of dynamics also from civil society that there are two few forces of civil society that demand from the government the ratification of this convention, because without some civil society pressure, it's rather rare any
international convention.
And
is there anything else that you think is worth mentioning about this International Day or about the
topic
itself that we haven't already covered?
There is a growing concern that particularly people that cooperate with the United Nations, like denouncing, in our case, for appearance or giving testimony over news within the country, that these people, for that very reason, are singled out and persecuted by the government or by some dark forces operating within the government, what you call
to try to convince people that we have to be in a relationship to provide protection for the system. The Committee Against Compulsive Appearance is determined to participate in any efforts to protect these people, because if we are not able to protect human rights defenders that wish to cooperate with the United Nations protective system, it will be very difficult, and it would be counterproductive. And that could be a source of danger in these people, and that would be the last thing we want to be responsible
for. Very nice. You as a member of the Information Committee on Health, and yes, I'm talking to you, see you on the call.
Second, there's always a breaking story. Kulchandre for Channel Africa Radio in Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa. For Channel Africa, I'm William Strava, reporting from the ICT in the Hague.
Reporting for Channel Africa, I'm Hilda
Kekeroa in Zambia.
Our cutting edge of hard-hitting journalism leaves no stone unturned, giving you the whole picture every time.
So it's
Channel Africa.
Blunter.
It's Blunter now, Fofana. Reporting for Channel Africa from Cape Town.
Reporting for Channel Africa in Harare, Zimbabwe.
This is Simon Mukeba.
Reporting for Channel Africa. This is Muki Kinzeka in Yaoundé.
From an African perspective,
listen to Channel Africa
in English, to Swahili,
French, Ilozi, Portuguese, and Kinyanja.
World about Africa.
Join us every day and know what is happening around you.
Channel Africa,
the voice of the African Renaissance.
Africa Digest.
You're listening to Africa Digest.
India time is 19:21 Central African Time. You with Africa Digest until
20:00 hours this evening.
The South African Traditional Healing Organization says the traditional healing sector cannot afford to continue in the financial awesome, not the government. And it provides a service that is to a significant portion of the republic. The organization held a commemorative event of the African Traditional Medicine Day in Western Area on the West Rand in Johannesburg, where politicians were urged to understand the need to fund and develop traditional medicine. Jane Matebuna earlier spoke to the organization's co-ordinator, Pepsi Lema Sese.
The North African medicine growing after that, it emphasizes on the importance of promoting, protecting, and monitoring practices conducted by traditional health practitioners as providers of healthcare. So what we are emphasizing as an organization is that traditional health practitioners are more than they should be trained and qualified in safe and in effective traditional medicine. Because you can do anything and whatever that you want, but if you do not provide the kind of quality health that is expected of you as a healer, it is as good as nothing. So commemorating this day among others would mean we are recommitting ourselves to better quality services.
Let's reflect on the challenges that traditional practitioners are confronted with in their quest to provide quality health care.
I'll just highlight a few major ones. The first thing is that, no matter how much traditional health practitioners can open up to development, if we do not have a committed political will to assist in our development, it's as good as nothing. The second thing is that if there is not dedicated funding to develop African traditional medicine, it is a far-fetched dream. And the other thing is that I think we need to understand that in South Africa alone, about 22% of South Africans, they do consume African traditional medicine. What that suggests to us is that considering that African traditional medicine contributes up to 3 billion of the GDP of the country, it then means that politicians should now start to understand the importance of developing African traditional medicine as African traditional medicine. Because for a long time, African traditional medicine has contributed immensely into the development of Western drugs. But then we are saying we cannot only just be responsible for promoting and assisting the development of other sister sciences. We want to develop African traditional medicine in a manner and in a way that appreciates African traditional medicine is African traditional medicine. Therefore, it means we need to put in place legislation, we need to put in place policies that are favorable, that will assist us be able to achieve as a goal for this particular sector.
But particularly, why do you think that the push to develop the traditional medicine seems to be marred with challenges? Because we know that for quite some time there's been calls to incorporate perhaps traditional doctors within national health systems. Why do you think we don't seem to be making enough strides in that regard?
I mean, it's precisely because Western medicine, which is largely big pharma, you know, they take in all their profits into supporting political arms so that politicians can be able to take and resolve on how they will only develop just one system, which is Western medicine, allopathic medicine. They do not want to see any form of other medicine that may be competitive with what they are already giving out to people. So that is more a political program that they've decided so far in order for them to be accepted of future partnerships with government and of future partnerships with politicians. Now, that has worked against, you know, the only resolution to many declarations that the World Health Organization is.
Now, this year's 13th edition of the African Traditional Medicine Day is commemorated with the theme Regulation of Traditional Health Practitioners in the WHO African Region. If you could talk us through what this theme speaks to.
I guess the theme was put out in good faith. It was put out in good faith because for a long time, since 2001, the WHO made a declaration for a decade of African Traditional Medicine. It's actually frustrated that there is nothing that makes that what member countries are doing in terms of ensuring the institutionalization of traditional medicine in the form of putting aside budgets, limited budgets towards research and development of African traditional medicine being made by traditional health practitioners themselves. And secondly, the fact that modern medical education that was developed by traditional health practitioners themselves before regulating their own industry, which I think, and I know for a fact, we know better than anybody. So WHO is actually expressing how frustrated they are, you know, in member countries that have not been able to implement, you know, the resolution from the declaration.
And finally, Pepsile, I know you've just stepped out of a conference where you are commemorating the African Traditional Medicine Day. If you could just talk us through what's happening and what are some of the key arguments brought forward in terms of traditional medicine, just to conclude our conversation.
Basically, what we are doing here is that we are celebrating African traditional medicine. We are going back to communities, to feed the communities. We're trying to create an awareness to say what exactly is the role of African traditional medicine. And also, how can we make an effort to protect the people that consume African traditional medicine? How then do we commit ourselves to monitor such practices? Because, you know, if the practices are not monitored ourselves, if we do not have in place relevant legislation that assists in the monitoring and proper regulation, whatever that is going to do here will not be able, you know, to bear the expected fruit.
Pepsile Masego is the coordinator of the South African Traditional Healers Organization, and she was speaking to Jane Matsebula. It's 1927 Central African Time right here on Africa Digest. South Africa lost up in the country is this week hosting a royal women from the African continent and the Middle East for the second annual East, West and Africa Women's Initiative Forum. The gathering, which is part of the community engagement initiative, is taking place on the 3rd and 4th in Phokeng, Rustenburg in the Northwest Province. More from Phil, who is the Africa representative for the conference.
This was an initiative that was initially started by one of the royal family members from Jordan, Princess Tigrit in particular, who really has a passion for women, just as the Queen of Jordan has a passion. And it started off with a gathering of women from the Middle East. It extended to women from the Western nations and eventually reached us here in Africa. And so that's hence the acronym EWA, EWA, East, West, and Africa, Women from Africa. We are focusing this year on women in business. Last year we met in Jordan, and I had the privilege of traveling with Nemafulu, who is part of our group from South Africa. And we were seven, including Tami Ngubeni, myself, the two princesses, and we represented South Africa in the conference. Last year, the main theme was around women as change agents. what capacity do women have to be change agents? And we looked at the areas of education, what are the opportunities to be change agents in education, in social development, in leadership areas, and those were some of the areas. But this year we're focusing on business, because statistics show that in spite of all the legislation that we've had, in spite of all the good programs, and we tried to bring more women in to be in key decision-making posts, women really haven't made much progress.
Yeah.
If you look at the Fortune 500 companies and all that, and the CEOs, it's still male-dominated, and it's still males who are getting paid better than women are being paid.
Mm-hmm.
So we're meeting as women from all these nations. These are some of the issues we're going to be talking about. The session that I will be speaking on and chairing is a session that deals with women in business and some of the global trends.
Yeah.
What are the global trends that are happening all around the world? And one of the things that we really want to do, which is important for us, this is not about a women's talk shop and needing to wear pretty hats and drink tea. You know, because we've had a lot of those this month.
High tea.
We've had a lot of tea. We've had a lot of high-paid women, and we've worn a lot of hats, every color of the rainbow.
Yeah, and part of the whole the transformation issue, you know, and you obviously focusing on business, particularly this year, and
yeah.
highlighting, you know, that there's still some huge gaps in that sphere of
yes.
things. What has been some of the experience of some of the women that you maybe have spoken to? And if I can broaden this and ask, you know, in your view, as we conclude Women's Month, does it actually have any bearing in terms of any advancement that we see in supporting women in the business field?
Well, listen, this is what I feel around our Women's Month. I applaud our nation for celebrating women on August 9th and even for the whole month. But my views are that we mustn't just celebrate and acknowledge them. It must translate into actual progress. And we're not seeing that progress now.
Mm.
We're still seeing women being raped. I mean, 64,514 rapes, you know, in 2012. And those statistics are escalating.
Mm.
So clearly we have to do more than have parties and recognize and acknowledge them. We have to dig deep and drill and find out what are the root causes for women not progressing. Why are we not doing well in business? In spite of the fact that there's been affirmative action legislation for the past 20 years.
Yeah.
What are the stumbling blocks? So these are some of the things that we want to discuss in the program to say, you know, there's things like mentoring. You know, women, we don't mentor the way that men mentor. Men mentor each other on the golf club. They create opportunities for one another. They open doors for one another. Women, you know, we haven't developed that culture yet. So these are some of the things we're going to be looking at in terms of what is our responsibility as women who've made it in the business world.
Yeah.
What's our responsibility to mentor others and raise up other young women? And we mustn't buy into this big lie and the fallacy that the cake is too small, so that we're busy kicking each other down because we think the cake is small.
Peter Cooper, who is the Africa representative of the East, West, and Africa Women's Initiative Forum, and she was talking to the Prime Minister earlier. As Women's Month comes to its close in South Africa, the Higher Education and Training HIV/AIDS and Training Program, HEATS, is calling on people in the higher education sector to participate in continued a robust dialogue to address the ongoing challenges women face. Among the many issues the program hopes will be discussed beyond the month is the high HIV incidence rate among females, which studies say is four times higher than in the male population. Earlier, I spoke to HEATS director Dr. Aramnik Aluwalia to find out if the month was successful in addressing health and many other student issues facing young women.
So it was indeed. I think it's not just about the month. For example, one of the biggest challenges that remains for when it comes to women or women empowerment program in the higher education is teenage pregnancies. Our young girls become pregnant, and these young girls at the age of 18 and 19 are not ready for delivery because biomedically the wombs are not ready. And they also affect our throughput. Girls leave schools, they leave colleges, they leave universities. So I'm just giving you an example that the teenage pregnancy doesn't cease only in August. Yes, August is a month of women, but for us it's a year-long fight to empower women, to ignore it, to ensure that these women take charge of their lives.
But are these issues that would normally be discussed beyond August in South Africa?
Oh, definitely, yes. South Africa remains a rape capital of the world. So many amounts of rape that we encounter, sexual violence, gender-based violence. We are also discussing issues about breast cancer, cervical cancer. HIV remains the biggest epidemic among the women. As such, in a group, we have sexually transmitted infections in a very high number and growing in our women population. These are young South Africans. These are young, educated South Africans. This is our next economy. We need to empower and fight sugar daddies that are coming to our campuses and radio, in universities, in colleges, and trying to get these young girls, and that's the source of HIV and obviously the source of pregnancies in our sector. So this is a huge, huge kind of micro-epidemic among the major HIV epidemic that's sitting in our women population, and I think that's where we are moving towards and that's where we're engaging.
What do you think the problem is? Because if you're saying that these are issues that are being discussed, but South Africa still has a huge rate of HIV in young women, why do you think the messages then are not going across to young women?
I would slightly differ in your proposition. We're doing a lot of work as a nation in total, and I'm very proud to say, being an African nation, yes, we have a challenge, the epidemic runs out of our control. But if you see our growth now, the PMTCT program, the mother-to-child transmission, we already got it almost to 0%. And that's a huge difference regarding the positive factor of about controlling the incidence of HIV.
But Luana, I would say that South Africans, especially young South Africans, young women included, are suffering from HIV information fatigue.
To be honest, I tell you, young educated South Africans, if they take charge, they can actually transform the entire South Africa, and I say to every African, that if educated Africans take charge, they can transform the entire Africa. And I give you an example. There's a small village called Lady Smith in KwaZulu-Natal in South Africa. They speak Zulu. Zulu is a language that changes from Durban as you move towards Lady Smith. But if you see these young educated South Africans from our school called Community College, and we educated 20 of them to speak about teenage pregnancies, about contraception, about female condoms, you will be surprised that 300 girls in that village of Lady Smith took contraception. That was the power of these educated young Africans. These young girls, South Africans, educated, when they came to the community and they saw that Zulu that is heard in Lady Smith, most of these people in the community listened to them. They believed in them and they changed themselves. You and I are very difficult to go and speak and will be able to talk for what an educated young South African can do. So for me, the call from your channel to all the Africans who are listening is that if we put our resources, if we put our energy towards these new developing educated South Africans, can be a minder, a plumber, doctor, a genius, if they take charge, there will be a better influence in transforming South Africa.
Now let's talk about your organization. In terms of HIV and AIDS education, how different are you from other approaches that we've seen in the past?
One of the biggest programs we run is called First Things First. First Things First says first priority is every young South African to look after their health, not just HIV. And one of the biggest effects we have seen is when we brought HIV under the wellness sphere. For example, when the First Things First goes to a college, they will not only provide an HIV test, but they will provide blood pressure, sugar, cholesterol, cancer screening, TB, STIs, contraception, condoms, circumcision, everything at no cost to a student, us and those that. What will happen if he destigmatizes HIV? HIV is not taken as a stigma. He believes that if I'm going for a blood pressure test or a sugar, I can also go and do an HIV test. Even if it becomes positive, we put it immediately on treatment. And early detection and early treatment gives them a longer life. And that has been the biggest success of my program, or the First Things First. And that is why First Things First was awarded as the best program of Africa. Yes. And if we, all of our programs, because our problem is we say we are going to launch an STD campaign or an HIV campaign. Don't say we're going to do an HIV campaign. Say we're going to do an health and wellness campaign. And bring HIV as a normal test, like a TB or a blood pressure. And you will see that young people engage in more having HIV tests.
And I think that's the wing that we are proposing and we are wanting every African to do it.
That's Dr. Ramnik Aluwalia, Director for the Higher Education and Training HIV/AIDS and Training Program, EH, in South Africa.
This is Channel Africa, South Africa's official international public radio station on shortwave, internet, and satellite. From an African perspective, listen to Channel Africa in English, Kiswahili, French, Lozi, Portuguese, and Kinyanja, informing the world about Africa. Channel Africa, the voice of the African Renaissance.
Africa Digest. You're listening to Africa Digest.
Remember that you can also find us on the DSTV audio bouquet. We're on channel 902 over there. That is 902 on the DSTV audio bouquet. In marking the end of Women's Month in South Africa, the Minister of Water Affairs and Sanitation, Nomvula Mokonyane, today hosted a National Women in Water Consultative Conference at the Council for Scientific and Industrial Research in the capital, Pretoria. The purpose of the conference was to empower women in the efficient and equitable management of scarce water resources through their involvement in decision-making, developing technologies, and benefiting as water entrepreneurs. More from the Minister of Water Affairs and Sanitation, Nomvula Mokonyane.
For the past 21 years, South African government has done its work in ensuring that we provide access to this basic service with regard to water and sanitation. But where we have been found short of it, women have not been playing a role in the entire chain of water and sanitation. So today, as we round off Women's Month, one of the things that we're looking at is where else can women participate? Want women to be involved in the water sanitation and innovation sector, in the science and engineering, in small businesses, in promotion of entrepreneurship, in support of community initiatives. It is about that, so that then we don't only think of women in terms of us providing a tap in the yard. We want women to be part of the entire value chain of fetching water from a huge dam, having built that dam themselves, having laid a pipeline that will take the water into a reservoir in a municipality, and having laid the pipeline from a reservoir to a community and putting the tap. These are business opportunities. For South Africa to fight unemployment, inequality and poverty, women can't actually be outside of that. And investment that government has put on infrastructure, women must also benefit. 30% of our allocation has to be dedicated to women. But what you definitely need, you need a different kind of arrangement. So the incubation is about recognition of those who have the ability, give them the space. It's about realization that there's potential, give the opportunity to those who have the potential. It is about those who have an interest, expose them to the opportunity. But of importance, it starts first with knowledge, investing in the well-trained, in terms of bursaries, in terms of education, and then coming into the leadership of government as well. We need women to be part of those who are taking charge of water and sanitation in government. The situation now is not impressive. Yes, you've got the minister and the deputy minister and the director general. They are all women. But the department doesn't look good. Our water boards don't look good. The companies we have appointed are horrible. They are all men. Many are white and old. So we need young white people. We also need capable black women to also be part of that process. So it's about changing the water sector, and it must reflect the demographics of this country and the needs.
How many are the challenges?
The challenges are access to funding, access to information. The challenges is access to knowledge. That's why we must invest on bursaries. But the other thing, it's about the competition that always excludes women. So hence, you have to then create an incubator and a dedicated platform. And that on its own will then release women to participate on merit into the scheme.
Now, Minister, I mean, women have been in the forefront during matrimony, before matrimony, over 2 months. Now, why is it that now we're still talking about he may have you to play a role that
or play a role for somebody to go over.
Thanks for asking that.
Because there's also been a discussion about African culture. Because African culture that was not influenced by colonization.
You had the matriarch in the forefront.
And it is precisely because of that that women were the ones who had to go and collect water, collect wood, look after the house and do the maintenance of the house, and even be the ones who dissect the piece of land that is owned by a household for prosperity. But with colonization, because then the colonizer had an identity of being a man, there was also a distortion of our own African culture to an extent where then everything that was backward in our culture was left to women, and anything that gives an opportunity for prosperity was given to men. Women remaining at home whilst men went out to look for jobs was not necessarily a burden, but it has been made a burden now because there is no compensation for work that women do in their own households. As housewives in the suburbs and as women in their own homes, in the villages, in their homesteads. What we now are bringing is that we must now crush patriarchy. Because patriarchy came with colonization. The matriarch, even in the animal life, it is the matriarch that looks after the entire pack of lions. And even in true African culture, it is the matriarch that makes sure that the man goes to bed clean, with water, a toilet, a cigarette, and a plate. That is something that has to be recognized. Because patriarchy of nowadays refuses to recognize and compensate the work and the contribution made by women. When ordinarily, historically, in terms of African culture, the matriarch's role has been the one that has pushed Africa to prosperity. That's why you have civil wars today. And who are in the receiving end is women and children. That's why we're saying, even with the competition on water availability, if we can have the third world war that is going to be influenced more by water, people are going to suffer, our women. So you must create stability. We need peace and stability in Africa so that women can be protected. We need prosperity of women so that you know that you don't creating a triple BEE of a man who look after himself. When you give a woman an economic opportunity, you know, it's not only his immediate biological family, it is the entire family and the neighborhood that is actually benefiting. So yes, matrimony has actually delayed development of Africa.
That's South Africa's Minister of Water Affairs and Sanitation, Nomvula Mokonyane, talking to Wandile Khalipa. It's 1946 Central African Time, time for economic issues. With Sani Mathebula.
Thanks, Pumelele. The South African government has accepted that not all jobs will be saved in the mining sector. Its statement comes after the sector confirmed that it signed a broad plan with unions to stem a wave of job losses triggered by falling commodity prices and soaring costs. The plan includes boosting platinum by promoting the metal as a central bank reserve asset. It also seeks to make commitments to delay layoffs and sell distressed mining assets instead of closing them. Minerals Resources Minister Makura Matori says they are considering several measures to alleviate the job losses.
Such as what has been referred to as government begin to contribute towards retraining and reskilling more or less 11,798 potential job losses. And we want to deal with this number as effectively as we can.
Newly released figures shows that South Africa's trade account has swayed back into a negative territory, recording a trade deficit of $35 million in July. This comes after two consecutive months of surpluses. The deficit is expected to keep putting pressure on the rand, which fell to a record low last week. Increases in the vehicle and equipment imports have been weighing down on the trade account. Economist Lesiba Motata.
The challenge about South Africa at the moment is that the denominator of all these ratios, including the current account deficit as a percentage of GDP, is that the denominator is deteriorating. And this is problematic because you get a fire that the ratio has become burdened. And if the numerators improving, but if your denominator is deteriorating, you're going to have to either have a situation where the current account deficit may be a little change as a result.
Africa's richest man, Nigerian Aliko Dangote, says he will build a cement plant in Zimbabwe. This is a major boost for the southern African country that is desperate for foreign investment. The billionaire, whose business empire includes Dangote Cement, also told journalists after meeting Zimbabwe's Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa that he aims to invest in coal mining and power generation. And the Zimbabwean government is reportedly set to fire thousands of civil servants as it seeks to reduce its wage bill. President Robert Mugabe's administration is reported to have agreed to lay off thousands of civil servants to reduce its wage bill from 83% to about 40% of state annual expenditure. The senior official says that they want to force everyone aged 55 years and above to retire. If government goes ahead with the plan, affected workers will join thousands of workers who've lost their jobs in the past month. And Nigerian stocks rose more than 2% on the view that last week's dip to a six-month low on weaker oil prices and faltering growth was overdone. Nigeria's benchmark stock index rose 2.5% to 29,550 points, with investors buying across the board in banking, breweries, cement, and energy sector stocks. The Nigerian market, which has the second biggest weighting after the Kuwaiti Stock Exchange on the MSCI Frontier Market Index, remains at a five-month low. And that's your economics news for now.
Thank you very much for standing here as Tammy in the studio with your sports news.
Here's the last edition of Sports Bulletin. My name is Tammy Kusa. Let's start with soccer, where South Africa's Bafana will play against Senegal in the Nelson Mandela Challenge on the 8th of September at the Orlando Stadium in Soweto, south of Johannesburg. Bafana will welcome the Teranga Lions, who are ranked 5th in Africa, just 3 days after they travelled to Morocco to face Mauritania in an AFCON 2017 qualifier on the 5th of September. Bafana coach Ephraim Sheikh Mashaba says that they want a different approach against Senegal.
My approach in everything I do, it's a leadership approach. I don't talk negatively. If I always approach a thing, I approach it with a winning mentality, champion's mind. And when I venture into something, I'm not going to take the chance. I'm going to play. Such questions, I don't have the self to put them in. I tell everybody, whatever I do it 101%. If it didn't work well, it gives us a chance to come back and sit down and say, yeah, we tried, but we failed yet. Let us keep on going.
With the two matches coming close to each other, Mashaba says that he's not worried about the Lions of Teranga, but he's happy that his players will be active.
I did indicate and remind you about the program that we had when we played the qualifiers. Some of you traveled with us, they know what we went through. But I do believe and I'm happy if we play games close to one another. The running game, it keeps the momentum.
It doesn't break the momentum.
Imagine you play a game this coming weekend, you're going to play another game in another 6 or 7 weeks. It's like starting from scratch. The program that is coming as well, I'm happy about it because it keeps us on our toes all the time. There is no resting time.
And now in rugby, South African Springbok rugby captain Jacques de Villiers says that he is 2 weeks away from being able to take the contract and reveals that the doctors have given him the green light to be able to play in the Springbok first pool match against Japan in the Rugby World Cup.
Probably 2 weeks away. I saw the doctors this week. I'll basically be able to play in 2 weeks now. So definitely be able to play the first game against Japan, or, you know, something going wrong along the way. So running Jimmy Hall is
doing all of that stuff, it's just not taking contact. So, and it's never bad missing Richie Gray's breakdown drill. So I'm actually in a very good position.
And now in hockey, with the Africa Cup set to kick off here in South Africa in October, South African men's national team coach Fabian Gregory says that he will use the upcoming inter-provincial hockey tournament as a platform to search for players to select them to the national team. However, Gregory says that he will choose players based on form.
And I've always been open to picking players, never mind what their age is, and I'm going to continue that. We're going to look at picking players that are on form. And I think if I look around the leagues, there'd be some interesting results across the country in the respective leagues. And there are some players who maybe didn't perform as well as they did leading into World League Two, but definitely leading into altitude, they bring a lot of form with them.
And finally, Kenya's 1,500 meters gold medalist Asbel Kiprop says that he's delighted to be part of Kenya's medal table topping team at the 2015 World Championships in Beijing. Following his dramatic victory yesterday, Kiprop says that he had executed his plan to perfection in bringing Kenya their 7th gold medal of the championships, their 16th medal overall.
Oh, I knew that when it comes to the last 250 meters, remember that's how McLaughlin won Olympics in London, he ran the last 250. I've been looking at his qualifying rounds when he races, my colleague here, he's been running through them the last 250 meters.
And that's the end of our sport. Stay tuned to Channel Africa and back to Spumelele Zondi.
Thank you very much, Tammy. It's right in 55 Central African Time. Let's repeat my top stories. An Egyptian court has sentenced three journalists to 3 years in prison. Detention without trial is still a major headache for rights groups. In economics, Zambia's kwacha falls 2.1% against the US dollar. And in sports, South Africa's Bafana Bafana to play against Senegal in the 2015 Nelson Mandela Challenge. And that wraps up Africa's Nations for today. For myself, it's Pumelele Zondi, producer Leander Mawomete, with our producer Charles Moyer, and the rest of the Africa Digest team. Thank you very much for listening. Send us emails on info@channelafrica.co.za, info@channelafrica.co.za. SMSs must go to +27796 957930, +27796 957930. And tweet must go to Channel Africa 1. Taking us at the top of the hour is Ungowa by Afrotech.
I'm so sorry, yeah.